Hello, and welcome to a special episode of the Who's Who podcast.
And welcome to a special episode of Justice Society Presents podcast, both proud members of the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
I'm one of your hosts, folks, the irredeemable Shag, and with me, as you just heard, is my esteemed co-host, Rob Kelly. Now, today's topic is just too big to be contained by just one podcast alone. That's why it's on both the Who's Who feed and the JSA Presents feed, because today we're going to be talking about the recent comic book called The New Golden Age, and this issue contains obvious connections to our beloved JSA.
And it also contains several brand new Who's Who entries done in the classic style of the original Who's Who series, dot matrix borders and all.
Classic. It's amazing. It's so exciting. Lots of people messaged us when the news was breaking, this was coming out, and it was just so exciting. And when it ran out, I mean, I don't buy a lot of new comics, but I definitely bought this one. Was super excited about this.
Yeah, this is the first regular new DC comic I bought, I think. I don't know, 5 years maybe? It's been a while.
Well, I still read quite a bit on DC Infinite. In fact, I upgraded to the Ultra, but I wasn't going to wait 1 month for this one. I had to jump on it right away. You know, I mean, everything's coming up Who's Who right now, because not just this, right? But also, by the time you guys hear this, right, Who's Who Volume 2 Omnibus comes out this week. In fact, it drops 2 days after this episode's released. So everyone's going to be able to get all the loosely printed in that giant omnibus format. It's going to be awesome. So, and on the flip side, the JSA, right? So since the last time we recorded, the Black Adam movie's out there, you know, it's got Dr. Fate and Atom Smasher and Cyclone and Hawkman and, oh my gosh, and Black Adam, obviously, so JSA's everywhere as well.
Isn't it amazing that, like, Dr. Fate can be in a movie and it's not, like, the number one thing on our minds that we,
Right, yeah.
Being an adult sucks. Speaking of being an adult and sucking, recently Shag and I actually got together because, as I've mentioned, good segue there. As I mentioned on some other episodes of my other shows, I am in Florida for the time being. And
is that Shag, what that smell is?
That's right. And Shag. Okay. Shag was nice enough to drive all the way from where he lives, which is some godforsaken bog, to over where I am, which is the Villages, which is a retirement community. I'm not that old yet. Everybody calm down. If you haven't heard of the Villages, it is the STD and voter fraud capital of this part of Florida. So, you know, that's fun.
It is the largest retirement city community in the country.
It's Disneyland for old people.
Yes, it is.
They call it. Exactly what it is.
And my mom lives there, which is why it was so easy for me to pop down and see Rob.
Absolutely. And it was absolutely great. We had a really great time. We went bowling. We took pictures of that and put them up on the interwebs for everyone to see. Shag won one game. I won one game. Unfortunately, we didn't have time for a tiebreaker game. The guy at the counter had an Australian accent, and I really want to know what his life story is. You know, how do you end up in Australia? And then leads to running a bowling alley in the Villages, Florida. Like, you know, what is that? What's that trajectory? But no, we had a great time. And one of the things that we did is we went to a local comic store. We found the nearest comic store to where we were, which was called Bearded Brown Coat
in Bellevue, Florida.
Bellevue, Florida. I mean, I get the reference, but man, talk about, you know, an anti-commercial way of naming your business. But we went in there, and like a lot of comic shops nowadays, they're comic shops in name only, and that they carry comics, but they are mostly a Funko Pop distribution center.
they have a lot of games there too, though. They had a lot of like miniatures games and card games, stuff like that. So they clearly were doing well, but the stuff we're looking for, there wasn't a lot of.
Yeah, we spent a lot of time going through back issue bins. Shag found a whole pile of Marvel 2-in-1s that he liked, and I grabbed one out of his hand and bought that.
I was totally going to buy it, too.
Yeah, well, too bad. And then, but also, you bought the first 6 issues of what book,
Shag? Of the classic Kickers, Inc. Yeah. I have to credit our buddies Sean and Greg over at the Never Ending Reading Pile, because I've been on the way down. I've been listening to them talk about a recap of a bunch of new Marvel New Universe stuff. So when I came across the first 6 inches of Kickers, Inc., I had to buy it. I read the first couple. They're a bit rough, but thankfully I didn't have to pay for them. Rob bought them for me. So thank you, Rob.
Never have you found a man more excited about finding 6 straight issues of Kickers, Inc. That's never happened before in the history of anything. So yeah, we had a really, we had a really great time. It was great to see you, Shag. No joke. We had lunch with my wife, which was awesome. That was great. She thanks you for lunch, by the way. So yeah, we had an absolutely great time. I wish we could have hung out, even more, but it was super fun. And that's even related. You know, we're talking about Funko Pops. That's even related to more news of things that the Fire and Water Network makes happen, because they just released news of a composite Superman Funko Pop, which is less than a couple of months after our Who's That episode about that very character. Coincidence? I think not.
Making it rain, folks. Making it rain. We talk about something on the network. Next thing you know, it's out there in the general populace. That's how it works. That's how the Aquaman movie gets made.
I love how that we have power over time and space, and this is what we use it for, is combining Superman Funko Pops.
So coming on the next episode of Once Upon a Geek, I'll be talking about what I would do if I won the lottery. So hoping this power can be used for my own means. So, yes. All right. So all of this, though, is leading to this new Golden Age comic, which is kind of funny because I think either the last episode of JSA Presents or one of the recent ones, we covered Golden Age. So now we're covering New Golden Age, which is a little thematic, I suppose. But very excited. We've got the Who's Who entries. We've got the JSA, which is cool because this spins out two series. It actually spins out a new Justice Society of America series, and it spins out a new Stargirl and the Lost Children miniseries. So we get two of those. And the Stargirl series, by the way, I think it's four issues. I can't promise you that. But either way, it's actually a follow-up to the Stargirl Spring Break special that was covered here on JSA Presents by me and Sean Ross all the way back in July 2021. It took them that long to pick up the threads of that story and keep going. I mean, literally, you could read one to the next. It's of a one piece. They should put it together in a trade when they do it. But yeah, it's been that long since July 2021 where that comic came out. But I'm excited for it. I hope you are too. There's a lot of cool stuff in here. There's a lot of Todd Nuck artwork. So I'm jazzed. I'll take it. You are as well.
Okay. Waiting for you. We have notes, Shag. I was waiting for you to move on to the next thing.
But before we get too much further,
it's like we've never done this before.
You know, it's been so long. So it's been so long. Anyway, before we get too much further, we do need to thank our sponsors, folks. This episode of the Who's Who podcast and the Justice Society Presents podcast is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 42% off with free shipping on orders of $50 or more. I went for the low-hanging fruit on this one, folks. I picked the Who's Who Omnibus Volume 1 because it's all the way down to $60, all right? So 60% off. This thing's, I don't remember what the page count is, but it's over 1,000 pages. It, you know, collects all the original Who's Who. It's got all those updates that came out, 87, 88. It's got the annuals, all this material. It's gorgeous. It's you could kill a man with it. It's so big. Obviously, covers by George Perez. It's amazing. And it's really what brought us all together was Who's Who. So it's a great opportunity. And it's down to $60. Hell of a deal. What'd you bring, Rob?
So, of course, related to a listing in this book, something I never thought we'd get, I went with Aquaman, 80 Years of the King of the Seven Seas. This is the deluxe edition hardcover. It's a new edition of the book, which is actually not out yet. It is the release date is February 2023. So and it has a brand new cover by Scott Williams and Jim Lee. And there actually is no price for it yet. I guess they don't know exactly what the cost is going to be in this. We don't know what InStock Trades is going to be charging. We do know it's going to be at least 42% off because that's their deal. But this book reprints tons of Aquaman stories, including some classic Golden Age Aquaman stories, including the very first appearance from Warfront Comics number 73. So if you don't have this book yet, get it. It features work by Morten Weinzinger, Paul Kupperberg, Peter David, Jeff Johns, Paul Norris, Ramona Fraden, Craig Hamilton, Jim Calliafore, Jim Aparo, and many others. You cannot beat this lineup. Plus, there's new text pieces and stuff by Mark Wade, also Paul Kupperberg, Bob Greenberger, our friend, and Paul Levitz, and a bunch of other people, and even stuff related to the movie, which, of course, was a couple of years old at this point. So, super exciting book. I have the original edition, so there's the new one coming out in February 2023.
So, folks, for these and all your collected edition needs, please visit InStockTrades.com. Now, this episode is also sponsored in part with your Patreon support, because, you know, running the Fire and Water Podcast Network with so many shows requires a whole lot of online hosting and services and things along those lines. And a while back, we realized we needed some help with the expenses. So we launched the Patreon, and you folks really stepped up to help keep the network going. So if you're enjoying either of these podcast series, the best way to support the show is by visiting our Patreon. And what's that Patreon, Rob?
patreon.com/FW podcast.
And while you're there, please consider supporting the network. And at certain tiers, you'll get mentioned on your favorite show of choice. Just like these folks who asked to be recognized on either the Who's Who podcast or the JSA Presents podcast. So our thanks to Alex Osias, Chuck Coletta, Corey Drew, Damian Whiter, Michael Atchison, Nathan Archer, Joe Tadello, Symbol Pending, David A. Gutierrez, Gord Tolton,
Jason Keen, Jeremiah Jones Goldstein, Joshua Romano, Noah Tarnow, Steve Givens, Ted Kilvington, Tom Perrine, and Tom Panneries.
So folks, again, visit our Patreon at patreon.com/FW podcasts. All right, so we're going to take a quick podcast promo break. And when we come back, we are going to dig into the new Golden Age.
A World on Fire,
an All-Star Squadron podcast.
Join your hosts, Billy D.
and Herman, as we take a deep dive into the seminal DC Comics series created by Roy Thomas and Rich Buckler.
We'll be covering the series issue by issue, spotlighting our favorite characters,
and talking about the historical tie-ins as well.
So join us every month in A World on Fire, an All-Star Squadron podcast.
It was 1938. The country continues its slow recovery from the Great Depression. While war clouds loom throughout Asia and German aggression builds in Europe, Americans seek comfort and distraction. It was a time when the most popular form of entertainment was radio. But a new form had been growing steadily and was set to explode. It was to become the golden age of the American comic book.
My name is Chris.
And my name is Mike. Please join us as we explore comics in the golden age between 1938 and 1955. All genres will be discussed, from superheroes to crime, horror, science fiction, humor, and western.
So join us for the Comics in the Golden Age podcast, available through iTunes and Stitcher, and visit us on Facebook or at comicsinthegoldenage.com.
All right, folks, we are here to talk about the new Golden Age, this 48-page one-shot, which just came out in November. So exciting. So the way this is broken up is there's a story in the front half that I'm going to do a quick recap of. And then where we're really going to spend our time, though, is talking about the Who's Who entries, because it hits both those bells. It hits the JSA bell and it hits the Who's Who bell. So that's really the perfect storm for you and me, Rob. So, all right. So the front story is, in fact, called The New Golden Age. It is written by Jeff Johns. It has art by a whole lot of people. Just to name a few, Jerry Ordway, The Extraordinary, Scott Collins, Gary Frank, Stephen Lieber, Todd Nuck, and many others. So here's my version of the recap of the story, folks. So the story features lots and lots of time shifts and hints of upcoming storylines. It's like a bit of a teaser, really. Part of it seems to be set on the classic Earth 2 of the JSA, but not all the story. And it is very intentionally confusing and very nonlinear. But if you really look at it at a macro level, the comic focuses on two main plot lines. So the first main plot line takes place in the future and follows a little girl named Helena Wayne, the daughter of Bruce Wayne and Selina Kyle. So we discover that throughout her entire life, she has been stalked and observed by this mysterious stranger. By the end of the comic, it's pretty safe to infer that this mysterious stranger is actually Perdegaton, popping into various points of her life to keep tabs on her. Now, as Helena grows, we see her discover her father's secret, that he's secretly Batman. She discovers that after she stabs him in the kitchen, thinking that she's protecting herself from Perdegaton. And then we see Selina's outrage and insistence that Bruce not recruit Helena for his war on crime. And then we see Helena as a young adult, and we share her grief with her and Selina over the murder of her father, Batman. And all that kind of follows the storyline of what happened with Earth 2 in the old days. The timing's off, but conceptually that's sort of the same. The second plot line follows the JSA across several time periods. We're jumping back and forth between time periods, and it's not linear, but some of the time periods are like 1940, 1951, 1976, 3022, and even other points. But the main thrust of this plot is that Perdegaton is traveling through time, destroying incarnations of the JSA. And he always starts by murdering Dr. Fate. In fact, like at one point, we're in the year 3022. We see the future Dr. Fate brutally murdered by Perdegaton. Meanwhile, the Dr. Fate of 1940 is suffering explosive visions of Perdegaton manipulating history and something to do with numerous 1940 sidekicks that have been erased from continuity, which that'll become important later. Now, later on in his life, Kent Nelson then experiences further visions, seeing dozens and dozens of incarnations of Dr. Fate murdered. Finally, we catch up with Khalid, who's the current Dr. Fate, and he's working with Detective Chimp and Dead Man, and he's also worried about dying. And then, just because Geoff Johns loves to throw everything in, including the kitchen sink, we check in on some of those Watchmen characters, like Dr. Midnight and Silk Spectre, and Ozymandias' like big cat thing, and the recent additions, Mime and Marionette. And we also get a couple pages devoted to the Time Masters. But the final page takes us back to Helena, grieving for her father's death alongside an older incarnation of the JSA, swearing she will become the Huntress. So there you go. There's the story. I just had a few things to talk about, and you feel free to chime in here as you want, Rob. I thought it was interesting the different JSA periods they covered. Were you able to recognize any of the classic JSA periods?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you got the 40s one and then the Super Squad version. I knew you were I knew you'd be excited about that.
I was very excited. It was specifically after a battle with Vulcan in All-Star Comics number 61 from 1976. I loved it. And the interesting thing is they even pigeonholed it and said, this is 1976. So they're specifically dating the JSA to 76. So that means, you know, Power Girl's been around for a long time here. You know, Star Spangled Kid was alive a long time ago. And this is where you start to see a little bit of variation because, you know, again, Power Girl and Star Spangled Kid, part of the Super Squad, 1976. However, this is the where it deviates in history is the Huntress does not come about in the 1970s. Instead, Huntress comes about 18 years from now. So that is one of the minor differences with I'm calling it Earth 2. They don't designate Earth numbers in this, but it's mostly the original Earth 2 continuity, except Huntress has been changed. You know, in fact, at the very end, they show Huntress, you know, Helena, when her dad has been murdered. And we see the older JSA of that time period of, you know, 18 years in our future. So what's that put us? 2040, something like that, right? So we see Alan Scott. He's all got white hair and a beard. Khalid's an adult Dr. Fate. We see a much, much, much older Power Girl. Beyond middle-aged Power Girl. And then there's like a woman who's Flash, presumably Jay Garrick's daughter, probably is an adult. So that's sort of interesting. We also saw in the 1951 era, during the America versus the JSA, you know, hearings with the Congression.
Love that miniseries.
It's an interesting miniseries. I don't know that I love it as much as I do in my memory, but I don't know. So there was another thing I noticed that I thought was a little weird. There's a lot of focus on the date of November 22nd. Like it says, you know, November 22nd, 1940. November 22nd, the year 3022. November 22nd, 1976. So, I mean, they really honed in on that date, which I thought was a little strange. I have a speculation. Any thoughts from you?
Well, I mean, of course, November 22nd, 1963 is JFK's assassination. There's no way you pick that date accidentally. There's just no way. That's the most famous date, unless Geoff Johns is bringing Doctor Who in at some point.
That's the next day, the 23rd. But yes, that's the only thing I can think of. I also thought maybe it's the date that the comic was released, but no, that the comic's released on November 8th, so that was a little weird. So. And then final thought here, you know, Perdegaton, right? You know, we've been reading about Perdegaton most of our lives, right?
Well, finally, five-part JLA JSA All-Star Squadron story.
Oh, Crisis on Earth Prime. That made me a JLA reader, man. But to me, it finally like clicked. Perdegaton, it sounds like a measurement when you're buying like a lot of fruit, like a fruit, like by like a freight load or something. It's like, hey, how much for that freight car cantaloupe? Oh, it's $500 per degaton. You know, I don't know why. Now that's all I can think of.
I went to Sam's Club and I bought a whole lot of paper towels, but it's only $4.99 per degaton. So it's a good deal.
Exactly. So, you know, what comes out of, you know, in a minute, we're going to talk about the Who's Who entries, which is why we're all here. And by the way,
we're going to get to the fireworks factory.
Is that what you're calling what's about to happen?
It's a Simpsons reference. I know that's very old. It's 30 years old, but that's Milhouse's frustration of let's get to the good part.
Okay. Right over my head. So the thing about this is this comic spins out two things. It spins out a Justice Society of America ongoing. Well, it may not be an ongoing. It may be a monthly. We're not entirely sure about that. But either way, it may be a miniseries like 12 issues. But either way, it also spins off that Stargirl series. So a lot of what you saw in this sort of really frenetic comic, because it really was hard to follow. Like, it took me two times reading it to figure out what the hell was going on, is it's really just a teaser for the Justice Society of America series and the Stargirl series. I will tell you, I've read both Justice Society of America number one, and I've read Stargirl and the Lost Children number one. I will tell you, Stargirl and the Lost Children number one was incredible. It was so good. It was exactly what you want. It's Todd Nook on art. It was amazing. It's Geoff Johns writing the JSA like he loves the JSA, just like the old days when he was writing the classic JSA book that he wrote. It was so great. It is absolutely wonderful. And the Justice Society of America comic book also came out, and I bought it and read it. We'll just say that. All right. So just so you guys know, in this entry, in here, the first Who's Who entry we're going to get to in a second is a Golden Age Aquaman. You may or may not know, a little while ago, 9 years ago, Rob and I had a little bit of a tiff. A spat? You know, what would you call it, Rob?
When Titans clash.
We had an episode. What episode was it?
67 of the Fire and Water podcast, I believe.
Yep, Aquaman and Firestorm, the Fire and Water podcast, episode 67. We got into it. Now, I haven't listened to it in 9 years. I don't remember. I have my memory of what we said. I don't know what we really said. But we had a big old to-do, and we had a big old argument about Golden Age Aquaman. And by the end, we were like yelling at each other and just finished it. And the minute we hung up, what did we do, Rob?
Oh, we laughed uncontrollably, like two minutes.
Exactly. Yeah. We had so much fun with this play bickering, but all these comments we got from people were genuinely worried that the podcast was going to fall apart because we were fighting so aggressively with each other.
People did not want to have two Christmases going forward. They really didn't.
So we're going to reenact it today. Well, not exactly. We are going to have a discussion about Aquaman, Golden Age Aquaman. But anyway, so here we go. We're getting into the Who's Who part. There are 12 entries we're going to cover. And where this spins out of is a comic called Flashpoint Beyond number 6, which I read last night. I understood about 6% of it. And the idea behind it was the Time Masters either were overseeing or had rescued a bunch of kids that were, or people, I should say, that were trapped and pulled out of time. They were essentially pulled out of history and erased from history and were being kept somewhere out of time in these suspension chambers. And at the end of Flashpoint number 6, they all somehow get away. They all escape. They're all released from the cylinders back into continuity. So that's why we're about to have all these Who's entries for either characters that never existed or people have forgotten. So these characters have now been thrust back into continuity. And the new DC continuity, I guess, is what they're saying, is going to include these people going forward. And this is very exciting.
So these Who's Who pages reference a different comic than the one they're in.
Yes. In fact, they reference comics that aren't even real. Like it's fun. Like, we'll get into it, but
this Flashpoint number 6 is not this comic. So these pages are referencing characters that appeared in another comic.
Well, okay. So Flashpoint number 6, all it did was show a bunch of empty cylinders and their names. So it said like Betsy Ross, that was her empty cylinder. Molly Pitcher, that's her empty cylinder. Gotcha. Golden Age Aquaman. So, and all they say is, all right, in fact, they're saying, oh, these characters have reintegrated into history is all they're saying. So now all these characters are back in the timeline, essentially, whether they're new creations or not. And they're officially part of the history from the 1940s, which is really cool.
All right.
All right. So the first entry, Rob.
Yes.
Go.
Finally, we get a listing for Aquaman, the Golden Age Aquaman, the one that first appeared in More Fun Comics number 73.
Woo!
It features the classic original Aquaman logo from those strips, and it features artwork by Jerry Ordway and John Calise. I mean, it's like this thing was made in a lab for me to love. it's got our hero in his yellow gloves with his A belt buckle, and his belt buckle is an actual A with the crossbar, not just the little triangle shape that the Silver Age version has. And in the surprint, I get to say surprint again, which is exciting. We have the origin of young Arthur Curry was experimented on, although he's not called Arthur Curry here. He's experimented on by his father so he could learn how to breathe underwater. We see him on his throne looking actually very much like the Silver Age version. And then at the bottom right, we see one of the Golden Age Aquaman's most famous splash pages where he throws a bear.
A
polar bear at a bunch of whalers. It is one of the great images of the Golden Age Aquaman. And I mean, this is just everything I wanted from a listing. Now, of course, our dear departed friend Zoom Yukinori did a listing for the Golden Age Aquaman. And in fact, I will tell you, after the news of this book dropped and a couple of pages got leaked, people literally thought those were Zoom's pages.
Yeah.
That's how good Zoom's pages were, is that people were like, oh, those are fake Zoom pages, right? They're not really doing this. I'm like, no. They're really doing these. Those are real. But by the fact that Zoom fooled them, tells you everything to know about Zoom's dedication.
Well, you know, what's interesting is Zoom's original version, which I still adore so much. But Zoom also had a shot of Aquaman on the throne. So both
right.
in the surprint. So this version and Zoom's both has that. So I mean, Zoom was onto something. You know, he understood the zeitgeist of this.
He did. Oh, he had his finger on the pulse of all this stuff. He absolutely did. So I mean, it gives, you know, it mostly talks about his origin, and then gives him some brief talks about that he fought with the Nazis, and then it talks about him joining the All-Star Squadron, and then it mentions that he disappeared for a while and says, adopting the identity of Adam Waterman, he enrolled in Weston College to study marine biology. He retreated to the ocean soon after, and for reasons unknown, in the 1950s, Aquaman disappeared from the public eye. His fate remains a mystery. So we don't exactly know what happened to him now, because, of course, as this something we have discussed ad nauseum across various episodes of the show, the blending line, the line between Golden Age Aquaman and Silver Age Aquaman is very appropriately fluid, because he was one of the few characters that stayed published every month across DC's Golden Age and Silver Age. Even when most of their other heroes disappeared, Aquaman stayed in the back of Adventure Comics. So the line as to where this version ends and the next version begins is very blurry, but that is true of Superman, of Batman, of Wonder Woman, of all of them. And it's only because, again, I'm sure we'll get into it again, there was never a definable moment, at least in the DC editor sense, where this Aquaman started. When Aquaman got his original listing in the very first issue of Who's Who, it said his first appearance was More Fun Comics 73. They just jumped. They just went right to that one and didn't bother to come up with another one. That's the same thing they did for all the other characters as well. Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman. If you go look up the Superman listing, it says Aquaman Comics. It says Action Comics number one. Batman, the original Batman, I think Batman Detective Comics 27, and then they later revised it to a later issue, which, by the way, doesn't make sense, because that issue would have been years after the Justice League formed, so that doesn't make any sense. So none of it makes any real sense. Nevertheless, I am thrilled to have this officially in a DC comic, because he's the Golden Age version of the character, and I love it, and drawn by Jerry Ordway is just chef's kiss.
Oh, it's absolutely gorgeous. I want to talk about some of the trade dress of it for a second. So, you know, as we know, we always talk about our beloved yellow dots, right? The yellow dots around the old original Who's Who entry, which represented the printing process. It would start at the top very thick yellow, and it would move to the bottom with very spotty little dots. Here they've replicated the dot process, but they've used different colors, which is interesting. I checked, not one entry of the 12 uses yellow dots, by the way. They all use different colors. In this case, they use like a blue teal kind of color, which also matches the surprint, which I think looks kind of nice. Mm-hmm. You know, the surprint and the dots match nicely. The trade dress is almost identical as far as, like, you know, personal data, history, powers and weapons.
Yep.
The only difference I could find is it says full name, whereas the original Who's Who, it said alter ego. That's the only difference I could find. So, I mean, this is really, really being as faithful as possible. I mean, they really did a great job matching this up to the original Who's Who. It's beautiful. In fact, as you look through the different 12 entries, they use different layouts for a bunch of them too, which is exactly what the original Who's Who did. Like in this case, Aquaman takes up the top 2/3 and just prints across the bottom. Other ones, it'll be like a column on the right, or it'll be on the left, or, you know, above. And so they played a lot of fun ways around and in tribute to the original Who's Who, which is great.
Absolutely. Now, before we get dragged back and down into this discussion of this character,
I have more to say before we do that, but go ahead.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, no, I mean, you say what you want. I mean, we're having a, it's called a conversation, Rob.
All right. Well, no, I just want to mention, I did reach out to Jerry Ordway and asked him a couple things about this. And Jerry was nice enough to respond, because, like I said, I had so many questions and I limited down to just a couple. So this is what I asked Jerry when it came to this entry. I said, hey, Jerry, how did this come about? Did DC come to you to do this page? And he said, I was working on New Golden Age number one, and Jeff wrote these Who's Who entries for me. Simple as that. I was thrilled to draw Aquaman, as the character has a fun costume to render. And I said, are you a fan of the Golden Age version of this character? The inclusion of Aquaman throwing a polar bear in the surprint suggests you were familiar with the stories from that time. He said, I knew a little about there being a Golden Age Aquaman from my time working on All-Star Squadron, but seemed to recall that the character wasn't available to use then because DC editorial didn't see a need for an Earth 2 Aquaman. As to being familiar, I have an old issue of Secret Origins where the origin is reprinted, even though I hadn't read it in years. As to the polar bear, Jeff asked for it, as well as the scene of Aquaman's father subjecting him to experiments, which I found no reference of, so I made it up. The polar bear throwing is one of the first images I found in a Google search, so I assume it's a fan favorite. It's a wonky image and was fun to draw. I suppose if they were in a warm climate, those bad guys might have gotten a face full of shark, huh? I have a note about that in a second, but let me just finish up here. He says, do you have a favorite Aquaman artist of any era? He says, I really love the work Nick Carty did in the 50s to the 70s on covers later on, but also have a soft
hell
spot.
Yeah.
But also have a soft spot for the Aquaman art done by Jim Aparo. Both artists depicted great underwater detail. And then he also mentioned in terms of doing obscure characters, he says, when drawing a Stargirl special earlier this year, I found an obscure kid sidekick that the original Blue Beetle had and drew it into the story.
I could find that. That's amazing.
I mean, you know, again, like Jerry knows the bells and whistles of all this stuff. I will say one thing regarding the polar bear image. I mean, yes, if you Google Golden Age Aquaman, that image will come up. And I think part of the reason for that is many years ago, there was a book published called The Physics of Superheroes. And I submitted some artwork for it because the author knew I was an Aquaman expert. That's when I had the Aquaman Shrine going, and asked me for a couple of images of examples of Aquaman doing kind of amazing feats of strength. And I sent an image from JLA number 200, because of course I did. And in that chapter is that image of Aquaman throwing a polar bear. Because it was just such a crazy image. So even though most of the Aquaman 40s stories are still relatively hard to find, not all of them, some of them are still out of print, I believe, even with all the reprints they've done since then, that image is kind of relatively known. So I'm so glad that that Jeff asked for it and then Jerry worked it into the serpent, because it's Golden Age wackiness.
Oh, it's amazing. It's so good. Now, I want to point out a couple things. So we get the yellow gloves. We also get the yellow fins, which a lot of people forget. The Golden Age Aquaman's fins were also yellow.
That's right.
And then I have a question for you. So the trident is featured prominently in the main drawing of Aquaman and on the throne. Mm-hmm. Now, you and I have talked before about how the trident is more of a modern thing, starting with the superpowers action figure.
It really is, yeah.
So he didn't really have it in the Golden Age?
No.
Is that
–
okay.
No,
all right, that's what I thought. Which is fine, because there's other things in here too. I mean, this – keep in mind, this entry is not purely the original Golden Age Aquaman. It's tweaking it a tiny bit for this new continuity, because it makes a reference in here that he was actually asked to join the JSA, which obviously never happened in the original comics. In fact, the only superhero he ever met was Green Arrow in one panel. I mean, and technically that was more in the Silver Age anyway.
Again, it was in that weird time where you're like,
well, it was 1959, so that's why I bring it up. The Adam Waterman stuff, is that made up here for this, or
no?
That
he did that in a story. He did go to college.
Really?
Yes, he did go to college. Animal House. He did go to a college and under that ridiculous pseudonym, but he didn't use it as like, that's my identity from now on. It was just, that's my name I'm going to use while I'm going to this college. But that was just like a 1-6-page story. It was not any more significant than any other story.
That's funny. That is funny. I do like how it starts off with very little is known about the first Aquaman. And yet then it goes on for paragraph after paragraph, which I thought was hysterical. But so some questions. I mean, here, you think about this. So now they have introduced a Golden Age Aquaman to continuity. And, you know, it's not just a fun Who's Who entry. The idea was that he is now part of continuity, and that's what the Time Masters were saying in Flashpoint number 6, or Beyond number 6.
Awesome.
So what does that do for Orin or Arthur? I mean, you know, is this a separate guy? Is that him? I mean, I don't know.
I don't know what DC's doing with their parallel worlds at this point. I'm so lost on all this stuff. So I don't know. I'm just glad that he's in here. Get nothing else but this, we just got him drawn by Jerry Ordway. Like, that's enough fights.
Yep. It could be a parallel world. That could be it too. Yeah. Okay. Now, normally this would be the part of the show where I would tell you places where you could find the character. Well, obviously you could find Aquaman in movies and in comic books. There's some old podcast about Aquaman and Firestorm you could listen to. So it's time for that discussion, Rob. So, folks, all the way back 9 years ago, the argument Rob and I had and still have to this day is that the Golden Age Aquaman I want to make sure no one misunderstands. I've never denied the existence of the Golden Age Aquaman. The argument is whether the Golden Age Aquaman existed on Earth 2 or whether he didn't. He obviously existed, but where does you fit him in continuity? So I've got a lot to say. Rob, do you want to start off your position that the original Aquaman did exist on Earth 2? Is that
that's
your position?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Is that and you're done? That's your
okay. Case? Look, the short version of it is because we have 11 other entries to get to, but the argument that I make is that DC was making shit up as they were going along, as we all know, right? Outside of Julius Schwartz having some sort of plan, it was all just made up. You know, they were just like patching things together as best they could. And it dawned on DC at some point in the 60s, the late 60s, that the Superman and Batman that they were currently publishing could not be the same characters from World War II. That didn't make any sense to them. So they were like, okay, well, retroactively, there were two Supermans, there were two Batmans, there were two Wonder Womans. And those are the three characters that they concentrated on, obviously, because those are the three stars of the line. Those are the, you know, they were all headliners. Nobody really thought about Aquaman or Green Arrow, or even for that matter, Plastic Man or Black Hawk, you know, any of those characters. And they didn't, because they weren't deemed important enough to really worry about. But at some point, all the editors, just not even all the editors, I think they just got to get, some others got together and said, oh, you know what? All the Superman stories pre whatever date is, that's the Earth 2 Superman. And all of a sudden, the Superman that shows up in the Justice League JLA, JSA team ups has gray on his temples. That's the way, and his S is a little different. Oh, Batman, that's the old Batman. Okay, now that's the old Wonder Woman. And they never appeared in like the JLA, hardly ever appeared in the JLA, JSA team ups. They almost never, you know, mix those characters together. Did occasionally, but hardly ever. So that to me is the DC just decided arbitrarily, okay, those are the old versions, and yeah, maybe the dates don't match up, but who really? I mean, you know, for the longest time, DC was saying, oh, when Batman got the yellow oval, that's the Earth One Batman. That's the modern Batman. But that makes no sense because the Batman in the Justice League, the first 5 years of the title, had no yellow oval. So what? That's the Earth Two Batman in Justice League? That makes no sense. So it's all just thrown together. The choice to retroactively say Aquaman from the 40s is the Earth 2 Aquaman was, of course, the work of Roy Thomas in All-Star Squadron. But to me, the fact that that decision came 20 years after the decision of the other three doesn't make it any less valid than anything else. He is the Earth 2 Aquaman because that's the Earth. We have an Aquaman in the 40s. What are we going to do with him? He's on the same Earth as the All-Star Squadron. What Earth is that? Earth 2. There, done. That's my argument.
I totally get that conceptually. If you look at it, the macro scale, all the old stuff's Earth 2 and just call it a day, that could work. My distinction is, and I know I'm planting my flag in something really niche here, guys. But first off, let's just point out one thing. You talk about the yellow oval on Batman. Just so we're perfectly clear at home, folks, yellow gloves on Aquaman does not mean Earth 2. Doesn't even mean the Golden Age Aquaman, because if it did, you've got a problem because the JLA's very first case and Brave and Bold number 28. Exactly. Yep. So obviously the JLA's first case isn't on Earth 2. Nope. So the yellow gloves argument doesn't work, folks. So here's where I dig into this is Adventure Comics 461, which is 1979. Okay, 1979. You know, there's a Justice Society story. In it, Paul Levitz specifically states that Aquaman is a character exclusive to Earth 1. He specifically says there is no Aquaman of Earth 2. And all the issues of JLA, every time they've done a team up, also sort of suggested that. They didn't explicitly say it.
No,
but it was implied.
Don't. Yes,
it was implied.
Correct.
A lot of times you'd see like, here's Earth 1, here's Earth 2. And you'd see the similar Supermans, the Batmans. And it was always like Aquaman and Dr. Fate facing each other or whatever,
yes,
right?
Yes, Aquaman or Wildcat. Some heroes are unique. Yes, absolutely. Yep. That's absolutely true.
So when he says this, they were either retconning the Golden Age Aquaman completely out of existence, or they were retconning his adventures into being adventures of the Earth One Aquaman. He just had been around a long time. And that's my position. I've always said that the Golden Age Aquaman's adventures were retconned as to being the early adventures of Earth One Aquaman. Not necessarily that he was around in the 40s, because it doesn't matter. He never interacted with anybody in the 40s, except for one appearance with Green Arrow, and that was 1959.
And so there is one panel where he mentions Johnny Quick.
Oh, okay. All right. That's fair. But, you know, given how much continuity people just choose to forget to make stories work anyway, you know.
Yes.
So again, he never interacted with anybody. They specifically said he never existed on Earth 2. So I take that as, okay, you know, I accept that. Then, you know, you mentioned the Superman stuff. So if you think about it here, Superman of Earth 2, he first appeared in JLA number 73 in August 1969. So you already said it. Prior to that, there was no Earth 2 Superman. Everyone happily acknowledged that there was just one Superman, and he'd been around since the Golden Age, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that is the point where the Earth 2 Aquaman was retroactively created, was 1969. No one argues that. Everyone agrees with that. And as far as I'm concerned, it's the same thing with Aquaman of Earth 2. He did not exist until he appeared in All-Star Squadron number 59, which was in May 1986. Is that fair so far?
Maybe.
Okay. All right. So Roy did reference, and I get that Roy is, you know, trying to add him to the, I'm not denying that Roy didn't add him to Earth 2. He did, you know, in his comic book, but my issue is whether I choose to accept that as canon because of, so there's a hint of Aquaman's existence in issue 31, which was in 1983, but Aquaman's not there. It's just like Liberty Bell's thinking about that there's this guy out there that they can't get in touch with. So he may not exist. I mean, it's not actually confirmation he exists. He didn't actually appear in the comic. So he doesn't appear until All-Star Squadron 59, which is May 1986. So here's my issue. That is when Aquaman of Earth 2 is retroactively created. However, it is published 5 months after Crisis on Infinite Earths is over. So it's not even pre-Crisis anymore. It's post-Crisis that he gets retroactively created. And Roy creates him specifically to get rid of him.
Just to get rid of him.
You know, Roy calls an audible, basically, is what he did. You know, he calls an audible 5 months after Crisis is over. And so I have a hard time accepting that this retcon that occurs in the post-Crisis era, just so Roy could throw him away in 1986, is that enough to completely change 45 years of Aquaman's history? Like, to me, that's not, I mean, everyone's happily, you know, says forget Mopey never happened, right? So why can't we just say that these two panels or whatever the hell they were that happened after Crisis, that maybe that didn't happen also? So that's why I'm willing to die on this hill, is that it was post-Crisis, that it was done specifically just to wipe him out, and it never existed before that. And I think it's shortchanging 45 years of history and the Earth One Aquaman, his history. That's why I feel so strongly about this.
Okay. I still disagree. I still disagree.
But in order to replicate the argument we had 9 years ago, I hate you, Rob Kelly.
Yeah, no, we've matured since then. And I just frankly don't care. Well, I like to think I have. I frankly just don't care about this stuff the way I used to. It just doesn't give me that bother. The reason to me, it can't be the Silver Age version is because his origins are different. He's a different origin. It can't be the same guy. This version is not the King of Atlantis and is the son of a woman from Atlantis and the son of a lighthouse keeper. This is a guy who was experimented on by his father and like artificially gave him the ability to breathe underwater. He's not the same guy. This is not the same guy. Now, why DC, if they had just in 1985 had bothered to go back and look at it, they could have said, hey, there's that issue of Adventure Comics called How Aquaman Got His Powers, which is the new origin. Mm-hmm. You could have just said that one. That's the beginning, because that Aquaman gets Aqualad, gets Mira. That's clearly this version. They could have just said, you know what? Aquaman Adventure number 260, I believe it is. That's the one. And everything pre that is all. To me, it's like, I don't get why Paul Levitz's word carries more weight with you than Roy Thomas's. What's the difference? One creator is making it up as he's going along, and the other one's making it up later on.
It carries more weight to me because it's consistent with what had been going on since 1941. I mean, since 1941, there had only been one Aquaman. It wasn't until Roy announces it in 1986 where there's suddenly a second Aquaman.
But I'm saying, but again, my argument is they arbitrarily decided that for Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman in the 60s.
Yeah.
So why it being done to Aquaman in the 80s is not as valid?
if Aquaman had appeared in a bunch of the if the Earth 2 Aquaman had appeared in a bunch of JLA, JSA crossovers, you know, over the years, yeah, absolutely would have been valid. Okay. He never showed up anywhere. No. Never appeared.
He was not a member of the team.
Well, he's never referenced nothing. So it just.
But he's not a member of the team. Why
I know. I think
him?
They overthrew all of that history in 1986 after Crisis was over. If they had done it before Crisis, maybe we could have an argument. I'd feel a little different. But all right. So this horse is officially dead. So we never have to have this discussion again.
Until the character shows up in like Aquaman 3 or something, the movie, when you do like a Flashpoint thing and he shows up there.
Could you imagine? That'd be crazy.
It'd be awesome.
All right. So let's get into further. Now, guys, the rest of these entries, we're not going to spend that much time on because
no,
almost none of these characters existed until this comic book. So let's get into Betsy Ross and Molly Pitcher, drawn by Todd Nuck and Mark Herms. This is incredible. This is beautiful. So what you've got in the front, you've got these two very young girls. I'm going to guess, you know, probably 14 or whatever, that are very patriotically dressed, sort of in the mode of Miss America, but with more clothes. They've got button-up collars. One's got a giant American flag as her cape. Another one is literally carrying a pitcher. One's a brunette. One's a redhead. And they look like they're having so much fun. The surprint here is a very like royal blue. Behind them, you've got a surprint of Miss America in both of her costumes because she had multiple costumes. You've got a large image of her in the more traditional costume. Then you got her in the later costume. You see the Statue of Liberty back there. And the gist of it is, so what happens is Miss America is trying to find this saboteur who was sabotaging a school. And these two girls, Elizabeth Rose and Molly Preacher, step in to help her. And they help her out, and they actually develop costumes, and they actually became Miss America's sidekicks. Miss America gives them each the enchanted items. She gives one of the girls a spool that belonged to Betsy Ross, the original Betsy Ross who made the flag. So she uses this spool to build create a cape, and this cape gives her strength and speed and flight. The other girl has a pitcher, which was the pitcher of Molly Pitcher, going back to forgive me, I'm having to look up my history here. Is that the Revolutionary War? Oh, gosh.
Yes.
Yeah, Revolutionary War. And this magical pitcher allows her to create weapons and tools and can even do flash floods and things like that. So these two characters become heroes and fight side by side with Miss America. In fact, one of the girls' younger brothers is trying to discover the origins of the powers. He wants to become a hero himself. And eventually, not too long after, the girls vanished on the day that World War II ended. Now, we know that they were then erased from history as well, and so they no longer existed in continuity. But now they've been reinserted back into continuity, so they actually existed now. So Betsy Ross and Molly Pitcher, what do you think, buddy?
I liked it. I liked listening. The artwork's nice. I will say, I don't think this is a surprise to anybody. When I bought this book, I immediately jumped to the Who's Who pages. You know, that was the first thing I looked at. Like, I'll read the story later. And this listing, because I didn't know enough about because they're mentioned that their first appearance is in military comics. That was a quality book. That was a quality comics book that featured Black Hawk and among other features. I don't know enough of that history to know that this was bullshit. I didn't know that. Okay. So we'll wait till we get to the next one. That was the one that tipped me off. But it was this one. I was like, oh, wow. I've never heard of Betsy Ross and Molly Pitcher. These must be characters that were just so obscure that I don't know them. And again, maybe if they had been if they listed their appearances as a DC, I would have said, wait a minute. How have I never heard of them? But military, I'm like, I haven't read a military. I don't know. So maybe it's plausible. And to me, it looked right. You know what I mean? So good on you, Todd Nauck. And I guess Jeff Johns wrote all these injuries.
Yeah.
Because you fooled me.
So, yeah, specifically about the first appearance, I did a little research, and this is not my research. I cannot claim credit for this. A guy named The Cosmic Moth over on the DC Infinite message boards did a ton of reference and research on these particular first appearances, and he does mention Military Comics 6 and 7, which are referenced here in the first appearances. There is some – you could kind of connect some dots to say there's some similarities in the stories to what they're describing here. But, yeah, these characters never appeared in there. They're taking extreme liberties with what writing that Jeff Johns wrote here versus what really happened. But, yeah, so now with the meddling of the Time Masters, these stories have changed some, which is sort of kind of fun. A couple other things I just want to mention. So Miss America, right, that's who their sidekicks to. So how long do you think Miss America was published during the Quality Era, Rob?
Probably, I'm betting, pretty briefly.
You're correct. Only 7 issues. That's Yeah. So this character's appeared right, you know, in theory, right towards the end of her run, you know, in fact. So very, very short towards the end. Let's see. Any other notes here? So again, we mentioned the Royal Blue. That also applies to the Serpent Dots, which is awesome. And I'm looking, I think that's all there is. And so these characters, by the way, have now shown up in the Stargirl and the Lost Children. So very exciting.
Okay.
Up next.
Next up, Cherry Bomb, which was the sidekick to the Human Bomb from Police Comics, part of the Freedom Fighters. Of course, that was later on. Now, this was the one where I got tipped off.
Okay.
Because now, even though Police Comics is also a quality book, and I don't know it the way I, you know, would know a DC book, I saw this character and I said, there is, because she's, for those of you not looking at the listing, she's African American. And I said, there is no way there was an African American sidekick in a 1940s superhero comic. There's no way they did that. So I knew this was made up. And then when I started going through the rest of them, and I didn't recognize any of these appearances, especially when we get to one of them, it's very obvious. So this was the one that tipped me off that this is like an out of continuity thing. And I was like, and I will say, I was for momentarily like a little disappointed because, and you can argue I'm taking it a little too seriously or whatever. Part of the thing I love about Who's Who, and the reason that the books are still so important to me and I still have them 30 years later, is that they are publishing history. They are true as far as DC could ascertain at the moment, or, you know, they made mistakes here and there. No thanks to Brenda Pope, but aspired. Thank you. It was blanking. They aspired to be true history, and these are not that, other than the Aquaman one, which is accurate. These are made up histories, and they are inserting characters into books that they did not appear in. And that's the only thing where I'm like, is that what I want to, like, who's not pretend? Yeah. I mean, of course it's pretend. They're not real characters, but there was just something about saying they appeared in books they did not appear in that just was, I will admit, I was a little like, oh, all right. Okay. That's all right. You know, that's it. But in terms of the artwork and in terms of the creativity behind it, I really liked it. And again, she's a sidekick to the Human Bomb, and it mentions in the listing at the end that her powers grew so out of control that she had to live in the containment suit full time. And the Human Bomb is trying to cure her when she suddenly disappeared. So there's the whole, you know, it kind of reminds you of, Sandy, the Golden Boy, what happened to him? Like, he, you know,
a little bit, yeah.
Wesley Dodds tried to cure him and he couldn't. He just grew out of hand. But artwork wise, really cool. Great name, Cherry Bomb. That's again, I don't think that was a phrase back then.
I Googled it. It was.
Oh, it was? Okay. All right.
Yeah.
All right.
I had to look it up. Yep.
I thought maybe it was more recent. But anyway, it's a neat listing. And I always loved the Human Bomb. I always thought he was like a cool character. So having a sidekick, sure, why not?
And that the shot of the two, Cherry Bomb and Human Bomb back to back blasting just looks fantastic. I mean, Todd Nuck, who is killing it on this artwork. I mean, it's so good. It's so good. Now, I'll take the opposite position. I understand what you're saying about being history. Right. But this is so much fun. Because if you sit here and look at all these Golden Age characters that had sidekicks, well, there's a whole bunch that didn't get sidekicks. So what's wrong with telling a new story? It's set in the Golden Age, giving them these sidekicks. And then, you know what? Just for fun, let's launch them with Who's Who entries. I think it's brilliant. I think it's an absolute, I mean, face it. Pretty much everybody we want out of the old days already has a Who's Who entry. There aren't enough characters to really talk about unless you're going to be like, oh, that character who's in one panel who Plastic Man helped. Okay. You know, so this really gives us a chance to expand it. And well, that's the biggest thing. It expands the Golden Age to tell new stories about these sidekicks. So I'm totally on board with this.
I have no problem with any of that. It's just, and I'm being very pedantic here, and I admit that, it's the listing of a book that they did not appear in, which makes the listing not usable for comics history. I wish they had just put Cherry Bomb first appearance Flashpoint number 6. You know, that kind of
thing. It's almost like someone's arguing whether Paul Levitz or Roy Thomas was right about something. So weird. Okay.
I don't think it's the same argument, but okay.
So Cherry Bomb, the serpent's green, as well as the border around there with the dots. So the thing about her, so Gloria's father was a chemist, right? And he worked with a Human Bomb. He ended up getting killed by these criminals, and Gloria wants to help capture the criminals. And Human Bomb says, no way. So she recreates the experiment that gives her the Human Bomb's power. So as Rob said, she ends up in the containment suit, all that sort of jazz. What's interesting is that first appearance of Police Comics number 25 that you referenced, there's a kernel of truth in that. In that, yes, in that story, the human mom does work on inventing this fluid that can open any lock without damaging it, which they reference in here. And that formula is stolen by a pair of criminals. What they've done here, though, is they've inserted Gloria's father into the story and her, which is kind of fun that at least there's a verisimilitude of it, I guess, you know, that the story does hinge on the same sort of principle. And so it's nice that they're able to put that in there. I like that. Okay. Yeah. How many issues do you think Human Bomb had in Police Comics?
Oh, not a lot. I also not a lot. He's really more famous for after DC folded him into the Freedom Fighters than he did in his original run.
I love saying this. You're wrong, sir.
Oh,
he had 58 issues.
Oh,
of
shit.
Police Comics.
I didn't know that.
Who
good
knew
for him?
I know him. Awesome. All right. Who's next?
Harlequin's Son. But again, by Jerry Ordway and John Cleese. Now, this is funny. They're doing the retroactive continuity thing even more recently because they're saying his first appearance is Infinity Inc. number one,
mm-hmm.
which I owned. You know, I was like, wait a minute. He did not appear in this. He's got one of those costumes that is the kind of thing where no one would want to draw this character more than once or twice because he's so complicated. He's got so much. He's got bells on his shoes and he's got striped. One leg is striped. Another one is plain. And then he's got the kind of like those little jangly things that jesters wear. And then he's got a kind of a Green Arrow hat. And so, yeah, it's one of those costumes that you're just like, yeah, this is insane. No one's going to want to draw this. We see there's a surprint of his mother holding him. And then there's a shot of him in jail. And then there's another shot of him taking on Jade and Obsidian. Again, of course, beautifully rendered by Jerry Ordway and John Cleese. And then it mentions at the end, in terms of his relationship with his mother, which says Michael's relationship with his mother remains complicated. His too, huh? So I appreciated that. it's one of those characters that if you look at it, you would think is plausible.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it looks like they could have made it. And he has a name that is, you know, one of those ungainly character names that they're always talking about over on Batman Family Reunion, you know, where it's like the Joker's daughter and the, mm-hmm. this and that. It's like, what a terrible name for a character, the Harlequin Son. You know, it's like, we're going to call, hey, look, it's the Harlequin Son. Like, by the time you get all that out, he's already beating you up or whatever. But it's, again, it's a very handsome listing because, of course, it's Jerry Ordway.
Well, it's absolutely a play on Joker's daughter and things like that. Yeah. And the beauty of this is having it drawn by Jerry Ordway, who drew Infinity Inc. I mean, you could double take and go, oh, yeah, I don't remember that issue. Huh? Because you would totally buy it. Like, especially that shot of him fighting Jade and Obsidian. It just looks legit, you know?
As much as I hate to say this, Infinity Inc. is now so far in the past that it is pretty much equidistant in past from what Police Comics would have been when the original Who's Who series came out.
Oh, my gosh. You're right.
Pretty close. So to a modern comic book reader, Infinity Inc. number one might as well be Police Comics number 25.
That's crazy.
Comics were only $1.25 back then.
All right. So a few things. I love the logo for Harlequin's Son. I think it looks great. You know, so that sort of, I don't know. You could argue it's fontish, but I like the way Harlequin's Son looks as a logo. It looks nice. Did you read the entry? Because I know you historically never read these entries.
I did.
Did you catch anything interesting in here?
He
was an actor and he played a certain role in a movie.
He played
Nathaniel Dusk in a movie.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
That's cool. I like that. And working him. And was Nathaniel Dusk. I guess Nathaniel Dusk was part of DC continuity.
I have no idea. I don't know. But I just thought that was a fun nod to a comic that we knew existed, you know.
Yeah.
So.
Of course, that doesn't mean he was. It just means he could have been a character in this universe, but he's a real guy in the miniseries that
he did.
The two miniseries. So.
I don't remember if they come out and say it or they make it pretty obvious that Harley Quinn's son is gay. So that was sort of I like that they put that in there because, I mean, that's the kind of thing they would put in a 1980s comic. I can totally see that. His powers come from his mask. They create illusions and things like that. And then look at the picture in the serpent of him in jail. Look at those cheekbones. Doesn't that look like the Joker?
It looks very familiar. Yes. Yes, it does.
So it makes you wonder. We don't know who the father is, right? So it does kind of make you sort of poke around your head wondering, oh, could that have been what the secret was? Did Harlequin hook up with the Golden Age Joker or something like
Joker
that?
Joker has a thing for kind of clown girls. We know that.
Harlequin. Yeah, he does. So let's see. Now, interestingly, in Justice Society of America number one, the new comic that just came out, he does appear in that comic. So I'll just leave it at that. You guys can find out for yourselves. Olive green is our surprint color. Nice. All right. Up next is John Henry Jr., which is great. So here you've got, it's by Todd Nuck and Matt Helms. You've got the character of John Henry. So he's in overalls, a white t-shirt, his sleeves are rolled up. He's an African-American man wearing gloves, and he's carrying a large hammer, like a sledgehammer, and he's wearing an executioner's hood over his head, and he's coming at you. And in the background is a similar version of the same character, slightly different, though, because he's got a noose around his neck, and he's carrying two hammers. That's actually the previous person who carried the hammers. And then in the you also got in the surprint, because you always get the character without their mask on. In the surprint, you've got him looking shocked as he's holding this particular sledgehammer. So the gist of it is, John Henry Jr., at the age of 4, this is horrific, he had to watch the KKK set fire to a neighbor's house, and most of the family died in the fire. But there was one survivor that they tried to lynch. And this survivor comes back later with it wearing an executioner's hood, carrying two hammers, and he takes out justice against the KKK. Sadly, he is murdered, though, unfortunately, and the murder is covered up by the police. And this actually causes a major scandal and helps push the civil rights movement forward. So there's something at least good comes out of it. So John Henry Jr., his real name is John Henry Irons, by the way. So he actually takes up one of the hammers. He's given one of these hammers, and he goes, puts on executioner's hood, and he takes up the mantle of John Henry Jr. and goes out and finds the killers. And he ends up disappearing, just like all the other kids in this book. So you see that reoccurring, that all these people disappear towards the end of their run. But the interesting thing is, these hammers he's carrying are the legendary John Henry. We were talking, you know, the folk tale of John Henry, these two hammers. And this guy, John Henry Jr., has one of them, and there's another one out there. Somewhere that if he had both, it would make him even more powerful. But the one hammer gives him strength, impervious, can create shockwaves with it. And the other interesting thing is, they're saying retroactively that this John Henry Irons, who goes by John Henry Jr., is in fact the great, I guess it's great uncle. Is that right? Am I saying that right? I'm looking here. Yeah. The great uncle of John Henry Irons Steel from, you know, the Superman book, Steel. So he is now a legacy character.
Very fun, and I loved him in the New Frontier, which is his first appearance.
Exactly. So this is one new appearance that is real.
Yeah, that's right. That's a real one. Yep.
So DC New Frontier number 6. Now, I'm not sure which of the John Henry Juniors it was, whether it's the one that was murdered or the one here in the front. I don't know which one appeared in New Frontier number 6, but yes, that is in fact the first appearance. So your surprint here is a very, very dark, dark, dark gray, almost midnight blue, really, which looks really nice. What do you think of the art on this one?
It's nice. I wish the main figure was a little bigger. Like, there's a lot of dead white space. But other than that, I like the positioning, him running with the hammer. I think it looks really nice. I just wish he'd just been a little bigger in the page.
Yeah. So I think it's a great character. It looks cool. I'm glad they're adding some diversity to the old, you know, the history. And I like it quite a bit. All right. Who's next, Rob?
Next up, The Boom, which is the daughter of Jay and Joan Garrick. And of course, you're saying, what daughter of Jay and Joan Garrick? She first appeared in Flash Comics number 10. No, she did not. It mentions that she is Judy Garrick, the daughter of Jay and Joan. It says, see if you can wrap your head around this. Jay first met Judy when she accidentally traveled back in time and helped her father during one of his earliest adventures in 1940. And then it jumps to the end where it says, Judy stopped visiting her father from the future after she was born on February 14th, 1949. However, as of this writing, no one remembers her birth or existence. So only to people well-versed in comic book nonsense does that make any sense at all. But of course, as we know, as a Flash character, they do this sort of time hopping all the time. And we see her, again, it's by Todd Nuck and Matt Herms. We see her running with her father, and then we see her inhaling the hard water fumes that gave her powers to her dad. And I like this name. I like The Boom. I think that's a fun name for the character. It's nice and short and sweet. And again, she just looks like a junior version of Jay Garrick minus the pie plate hat. So it's a nice listing.
Yeah, I absolutely love this. What a fun idea to have a Flash character who constantly goes back in time from 1963 to the 1940s just to hang out with her dad, you know, and be his sidekick, which is super fun. I love that. She befriends the turtle, you know, the turtle, the bad guy. She befriends the turtle's son who goes
by the name. We see him there on the serpent. Yeah.
who becomes the tortoise, and he's like socially awkward, and they hang out together and stuff like that. I think it's so much. I absolutely adore this. Now, for a long time, there's been speculation about Jay and Joan having kids. In fact, if you go back to Geoff Johns' previous JSA series, number 25, they actually pointed out that Jay and Joan found out they could not have kids. So they adopted an infant boy. And shortly after the adoption, he passed away from pneumonia. And this was incredibly traumatic to them and hurt them so much. So that's part of the reason they chose to mentor and embrace so many young heroes. So I love that retroactively we're now giving Jay and Joan the kid they always wanted. And well, she looks so cool. So I love it. And she, just like the other heroes, these young ones drawn by Todd Nuck. All the ones drawn by Todd Nuck, by the way, are for the Stargirl storyline, if that's not obvious. So we get to see her there. Her name is Judy Garrick. So I just absolutely adore this. I love it. I love it. Love it. Her surprint color is like a dark, dark blue. And then you get the dots with that as well. All right. Up next.
Here we go.
I have been waiting for this, ladies and gentlemen. It is Ladybug, who is the sidekick of the Red Bee. Yeah, she is. I am so excited about this. So first off, I love the logo where it says Ladybug. It looks like, you know, someone hand drew it, because like the weird connective tissue of the letters looks kind of weird, like someone erased bits and pieces. I adore this thing. So the whole idea here is that Rosabel Rivera is her name. She was a young girl who her father ran a bee farm. Okay. Her father named Miguel. And Miguel was secretly actually helping the Red Bee. He was helping him train bees. So Miguel was an ally of the Red Bee. So eventually the Red Bee actually builds his hideout on the bee ranch. And Rosabel finds the hideout. She accidentally gets exposed to this device from a bad guy called Professor Pollen, who also doesn't exist in continuity, by the way. And it gave her the ability to shrink to the size of a ladybug. So she builds these wings to fly. And she ends up becoming a sidekick and to the Red Bee. She helps motivate him. She's a morale boost. She's very excited about it. Sadly, after only a few adventures, she disappears, just like all the other characters erased from history. And I love this bit. I love this bit. So it says, after Ladybug disappears and the Red Bee is killed, because as you may know, the Red Bee was murdered very tragically. Michael, who was his bee that sat in the pouch on his, you know, that the Red Bee, his gimmick was he had a pouch on his belt that contained bees. And Michael was his traditional sidekick, the bee. He's just a bee, folks. Anyway, it says here that Michael was very long-lived, and after Red Bee dies and Ladybug disappears, Michael the Bee actually returns to the Big Bee Ranch and was never seen again. I love that they took the time to put that in the entry. I think that is glorious. I love this. So the art is this adorable girl. She's got she's not skinny. She's got a little bit of weight on her, and she's got this red costume. Like the tunic is red with a ladybug on it, and she's got the ladybug wings, but the legs and the arms are black stock, you know, what do you call that? I don't know. It's just tight fitting. And she's got red
pants kind of thing.
There you go. It's got a little red patent shoes. She's got little black antennas. I mean, she's so button cute. And the red surprint has got the Red Bee, and it's got her teeny tiny with Michael the Bee. You see her watering flowers. You see an actual ladybug in the surprint. This entry is just a class act. I love it. Say what you want about it. I love it.
Not since the Dove is there a hero named after a less threatening creature than Ladybug.
So, all right, question. So we talked about it. So she's the sidekick to Red Bee. How long did the Red Bee go? How many issues did he have?
I think I'm going to stick with my original contention of these characters. Red Bee, I think Red Bee had longer than you think, but still not that long.
Give me a number.
2018 issues.
2018?
2018? Yeah, 2008. Yeah. No, I'd say let's just go with 18 issues.
He had 24 issues.
All right, that was pretty close then.
And they're all right here. I don't know if you can hear that.
Oh, in your book.
In my hands. Yes. I just got a collection. Thanks to our buddy, Al Girding. I got the Red Bee collection, and I am loving it. It's so exciting. Folks, I have loved the Red Bee for a long time. And I'm telling you right now, I'm planting my flag. In 2023, there is going to be a Who's That episode on the Red Bee. It's going to be me and a guest, and we're going to talk about the Red Bee on a Who's That episode. I cannot wait. Now, one of the things in here is Rosabel's father is named Miguel Rivera. And, you know, the Red Bee's bee is named Michael. So Miguel and Michael, the same thing. So I wonder if the bee, you know, retroactively, the bee was named for Miguel, which would be a nice nod, I think. Okay. All right. So, first appearance, Hit Comics number one as Rosa Bell, and then Hit Comics number five as Ladybug. Those are completely fabricated. There's really nothing at all that connects those to it at all. All right. Up next is the Red Lantern. Okay. So this is interesting. This is not connected to the children at all. This is a storyline for the Justice Society book. You've got this incredible image of this Russian man who's wearing a costume that is very, very similar to Alan Scott's, but the colors are off. So rather than a red tunic, it's a dark, dark blue. Rather than, the purple and green cape, he's got a red cape. He's got red leggings. So it basically, his costume is dark blue and red instead of the colors Alan wore. He's got the yellow emblem of, it's even the same sort of train lantern on the chest. He's got dark black hair with a beard, the same Green Lantern stick on mask. He looks amazing. And I should have said, by the way, the art here is by Brandon Peterson, who knows his way around a pencil. It's absolutely gorgeous. In the surprint, which is a dark red, you've got the Red Lantern and Alan Scott facing off against each other with explosive stuff around him. You've got him charging on the traditional Green Lantern, but it's a Red Lantern. And you've got him holding a baby. So before we get into the bio and everything, Rob, what do you think of the art?
It's great. It's superb. Really dynamic. I love the surprints. The movement of it is great. The character itself just doesn't hold a lot of interest to me. I get a little don't do too many variations of blank lantern. You know, it can be, to me, reduces the specialness of Green Lantern. Although there's already 2,600 of them or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, artwork is absolutely terrific and dynamic, and it's just great. One of the best listings here.
Yeah. And the logo, they've taken the traditional Green Lantern logo from the 40s, which is like the train lantern in the middle and the green on one side and red on the other side with the flames. They've changed it to Red Lantern. It looks stunning. So the version of his origin is that after Green Lantern appears, after Alan Scott appears, the Soviets decide to build their own version of a Green Lantern. They harness something called the Crimson Flame. So this is not tied to the Red Lanterns out in space that they did during, the Sinister Cold War and all that. Now, it's a whole new concept. So the Soviets create their version and they harness the Crimson Flame, and he's got mystical based powers. It's very, very similar to Alan Scott. I mean, it's almost identical to Alan Scott. It's just red instead of green. He's the first Soviet superhero. His costume is insanely boss. It's so cool. Him and Alan become arch enemies. Once or twice they team up. And they say here that he actually has a daughter. And his daughter is named Ruby, who is, turns out her skin is red and she's a living power battery. She's just like Jade. Ruby, Jade. I mean, it's paralleling ridiculously Alan Scott and Jade and him and Ruby. It's really interesting. So Red Lantern is supposedly killed in 1951, looking for his daughter, and he's referred to as the deadliest man in Russian history. And we don't know a lot about him yet. We haven't seen that much about him. But I would much rather have this kind of Red Lantern any day versus the Skittles Rainbow Core of different lanterns. I think this was a really great way to create a very cool alternative colored lantern.
Okay.
All right. Up next.
Mr. Miracle. By Scott Collins, John Kalee. Scott Collins, one of my classmates at the Joe Kubert School, for those of you who didn't know that I went there. Mr. Miracle. I mean, this is DC going even further in the made up history direction, because it says he first appeared in Mr. Miracle number one, 1941, which is a comic that does not exist. There is a Mr. Miracle number one, but that's from the 70s. Of course, there was no 1941. They're talking about a golden age version of Mr. Miracle, which did not exist. And he has absolutely no connection to the New Gods version, except for the fact that when he gets older, he trains Scott Free, the New Gods version. So there's the connection there. But other than that, he does not come from, Apocalypse or anything like that. This is just, he's a completely separate character. The artwork is terrific. We see him falling through just through some glass. And then we see him in a death trap, and there's Oberon, and then we see him without his mask on. And then there's just this fun little bit of text where it just says the world's greatest escape artist, and it's in color along with the figure, but it's not a background piece. It's just kind of a design element where the words are just sort of floating in the air. It doesn't make any sort of literal sense, but it looks cool. It just looks very exciting. And so it's a great listing, and Mr. Miracle's a great character. So no problem in coming up with an alternate version. But yeah, this is DC going even further by now. Hit Comics number one is a real book. Ladybug doesn't appear in it, but it's a real comic. Mr. Miracle number 1, 1941 was just completely made up of out of whole cloth.
Well, yes and no.
Oh, lordy, lordy.
Well, no, no. Thaddeus Brown, he's a real character. He's been around since...
Yes, but Mr. Miracle number one from 1941 does not exist.
Okay, I just want to make sure that, because listening to you, I wasn't sure if you were clear that Thaddeus Brown existed before this moment or not. I didn't know.
No, no, no. Yeah, the character, but that comic does, there is no Mr. Miracle number one.
Absolutely. From 1941. They're suggesting Thaddeus Brown, who we met in the Jack Kirby stories as the mentor of Scott Free, they're suggesting he had adventures in the Golden Age. Absolutely correct. Yeah. Right. What I think is happening, by the way, in that really cool picture of Scott, Thaddeus Brown as Mr. Miracle, this is totally me maybe interpreting too much. I think he's smashing out of the border of the page. I think he's breaking out of the comic because he's escaping. He's escaping from the comic. And so he's actually those shards that are coming down are kind of similar to the colors of the surprint. So I think he's smashing out and that's what he's escaping. He's escaping from the comic. That's what I think is happening.
Okay. I don't exactly see that, but maybe if they had taken the border on the corners and gotten rid of it. They kind of done that, but okay, I'll buy that.
Yep. It's also got Oberon in the picture because, of course, he worked with Thaddeus. The big difference, I mean, for the most part, the things that are different here that's not part of Thaddeus's origin is, as you said, Mr. Miracle number one from 1941. And the other is they mentioned Justice Society Dark, right?
Yes.
This is the creation or the first time we've heard a reference to this superhero team in the 1940s, or at least I'm assuming the 40s, maybe it's 50s. I don't know that they included the Justice Society Dark because we have a Justice League Dark now, but now we're getting in continuity a Justice Society Dark, which is pretty cool. I find that pretty exciting. So nice entry. And of course, I love Thaddeus Brown. So it's nice to see he had some adventures back in the day that we don't know about. So I don't know where that's going to appear. I have no idea. I'm hoping we'll see Justice Society Dark in the Justice Society series. I don't have a clue, but I'm looking forward to it.
Okay. Next up is Quiz Kid, who is the teen sidekick to Mr. Terrific, who first appeared in Sensation Comics number 2. No, we didn't. Oh, by the way, it's by Todd Knock and Matt Herms again. In terms of the history, it really kind of gets into the thicket of made up stuff. It mentions that, Raghu, his real name is Raghu Seetharaman. I'm sorry. I'm butchering that entirely. But it talks about that he went on a case. He disappeared in the middle of his most difficult case. Whatever happened to Betsy Ross and Molly Pitcher. So of course, those are characters we just talked about that are made up, but it also mentions fighting the Spirit King.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, you know, the Mr. Terrific villain, except when the Spirit King killed Mr. Terrific in JLA numbers 171 and 172, which we covered on Fire and Water many years ago. And Jerry Conway, mentioned that he's an old foe of Mr. Terrific. That was made up. The Spirit King was not an old foe of Mr. Terrific.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's made up. There's no thing. So they're, you know, that has become part of his history now because he's the guy that killed Mr. Terrific eventually. But so it's just made up stuff upon made up stuff, which is, it's fun at this point.
Oh, yeah, it's great. So I love his costume. It is sort of echoes Mr. Terrific's crazy colors and stuff.
Yeah, he's got a sash that says Play Fair. The way that Mr. Terrific had the fair play thing on his stomach.
Yeah. So I love the character. Again, they've added some diversity here. I like that. You've got the great surprint where, you know, they're fighting somebody like Mr. Terrific's punching a guy and he's kicking a guy. You see Mr. Terrific and him playing chess. I love that. I think that's fantastic that they took the time at a surprint to show them playing chess. And then, of course, you see him giving an apple to the teacher because I guess the kid's a suck up. I don't know. But so, Rob, how many issues of Sensation Comics did Mr. Terrific appear in?
Now I think he had a fairly decent run of like 30 or 40, I think, or maybe even 50.
63.
Yeah. He had a long run in Sensation. I mean, look, Wonder Woman was obviously the thing selling that book. And then the other features like Wildcat were just kind of along for the ride. But nevertheless, yeah, he good run for Mr. Terrific.
Yep. I love his group affiliation. It's the Fair Play Fan Club. I think that's adorable. So
that's the original title of the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
It is true. So yeah, he was in a teen trivia competition that the Spirit King interrupts. Mr. Terrific saves the day, but he stays around to declare the winner. I love that. And he gets in this competition with Raghu, which is awesome. I love it so much. He's got a photographic memory, which includes like a sort of photographic memory for movement, sort of like Taskmaster, you know? So very cool. I think Quiz Kid is an absolute win. I love also, of course, the Mr. Terrific. So super fun. All right. Up next is Salem the Witch Girl. So is this the one that you said, okay, this is clearly not part of continuity, or was it Cherry Bomb?
No, it was Cherry Bomb. Okay. But I will say Salem the Witch Girl looks like she wandered out of Jill Thompson's Scary Godmother book, which is not a DC book, but she just looks like that.
Well, to me, it looks like she's hanging out with Wednesday from the Addams Family. But so it's Salem the Witch Girl, again, drawn by Todd Nuck and Matt Herms. So again, you've got a character who's erased from history, but it's going to appear in the Stargirl stuff. So the gist there is she is the sidekick of Dr. Fate. So they say here her first appearance is More Fun Comics number 56, as Rob likes to say. No, it's not, which is the second appearance of Dr. Fate, by the way, which I was able to check. I actually pulled it off my shelf. I have the second appearance of Dr. Fate. Thanks to you. You gave me that hardcover. She is not in that. And the story doesn't match up exactly what they say happens here. But the gist of it is she gets captured, or she's going to be sacrificed by Wotan. And so Dr. Fate gets involved and saves her. But the thing about her is she is cursed. Because of her parents' actions, there is this curse that follows her that people fall to what they call bad fates, people who grow close to her. So she avoids a lot of people. Anyone that falls, begins to care for her ends up having some really bad things happen to him. So eventually to try and offset this, she becomes a witch to start studying training to become a witch. And unfortunately, bad things do happen. Like Inza, Dr. Fate's girlfriend, cares for her and is almost killed because of the curse at one point. It's very sad. Also, Salem has a couple of sidekicks. She has a black cat as a familiar. And she has an enchanted broomstick, which is very fussy and doesn't behave, called Sweep, which I just thought was adorable. There's a great picture of her yelling at Sweep the broomstick in the surprint, which I absolutely love. She's got a little bit of hint of Clarion the Witch Boy going on here, but also a lot of the Dr. Fate. The personal data is super fun. It's very snarky. It's funny. Like, known relatives, none that I care to acknowledge. My weight is 95 pounds. Don't judge me. You'll regret it. There's a fun sense to her character entry. I like it. What do you think of the artwork here?
Oh, I liked it. Yeah, I liked it. I can't, stylistically, I can't see her paired up with Dr. Fate. Like, I would think that all the other sidekicks kind of have character costumes derivative of their mentors, and she does not. Like, she looks completely different than Dr. Fate. Different color scheme, just different everything. So that's the one thing where I was like, really? She's like with her green skin, for some reason, I felt like she was like maybe like a Spectre sidekick more than Dr. Fate, but obviously she's not in the narrow name of Salem. But I mean, it's a nice looking entry, certainly.
And I should have pointed out, her costume is designed to look a little bit like a pilgrim. Like, yeah, she's got the top half, which looks like a pilgrim uniform, and then the leggings is just like brown and white stripes, which is fun. But then she's got the traditional pilgrim shoes. So it is sort of evocative of, Salem witch trial era clothes. I'm a sucker for Todd Nuck. I love any design he puts together. So I absolutely love this thing. So, Rob, how many issues did Dr. Fate have in More Fun Comics?
Quite a few. He was basically the cover feature, except for Green Arrow, all the way till the book, till More Fun got shifted over to Humor Comics.
True, but he didn't start till issue 56. So he only had 44 appearances. He actually, in More Fun Comics, he actually led less issues than Mr. Terrific appeared in Sensation Comics, which is crazy. So anyway, I love Salem. Super fun. I really like this character. All right. And then final entry is all redacted. So you've got a silhouette of someone. You can't tell. You can tell it's a male, and you can tell they're wearing a Legion flight ring, and you see they've got kind of spiky hair, but that's all you can see. It says Legionnaire. Now, specifically, according to the Flashpoint Beyond book, this name of the character is actually Golden Age Legionnaire. So this is not a Legionnaire of modern era. This is Golden Age. So, and in the surprint, you see the Legion ring, flight ring, and you also see a time bubble, which I'm pretty sure it's not a Time Master time bubble. I'm pretty sure it's a Brainiac 5 time bubble. So every single piece of information is redacted, all blacked inked. So you really don't know anything. It's really a big mystery.
First appearance.
Yeah, you're right. So I guess what we're going to find out is that somebody travels back in time from the 31st century to join, the sidekick characters of the JSA. So I think that's pretty cool.
It's going to be Wave Rider, isn't it?
No, it'll be somebody fun. It'll be somebody. Although it could be an existing Legionnaire. They've done that before when they sent Phantom Girl back to the modern day. It could be Ultra Boys hanging out with, Superman of the Golden Age or something. I don't know. So that's it. That is the new Golden Age. Super fun. What'd you think of the Who's Who entries, Rob?
They're a lot of fun. As I said, I kind of wished they had not been characters that didn't exist inserted into books that they didn't appear in. I wish that you know, we were just doing Who's Who appearances again, but I also understand that's from an era that's kind of long past. So I'm glad that this format is still beloved to enough people that they would do it again. So it was a welcome bonus to see these again.
And I'm excited that they're expanding the history of the JSA, or at least the Golden Age, to add more characters, more sidekicks. So now we get new stories about these new characters. So I'm excited for that. I think it's super cool. And I can't wait to keep reading the Stargirl series. And I'm interested to see where the Justice Society series pans out with Huntress. I mean, that's a big – people love the Helena Wayne version of Huntress. And, you know, this version's obviously more modern and different. But there you go, folks. Helena Wayne is back as Huntress. So that should be interesting. And I also want to know more about this Earth she comes from. Because, again, it's really close to Earth 2, classic Earth 2. So I'm interested.
Anything that gets us Aquaman from the Golden Age, Drumbager, Roadway, worth it. Doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what the rest of the book happened. It's worth it.
Now, we're going to post just a handful of images over on our website, which is firewaterpodcast.com. We're not going to post a lot, folks, because, I mean, this comic is new. You need to go out and buy it. So I don't want to put them all out there just so, you know, so you can dodge that. Go out, buy the comic. Support this issue. Tell, you know, that you're telling DC Comics that we want more stuff like this. So there'll be just a couple, and it'll be attached to the Who's Who gallery page. I'm not going to do a JSA. I'm not going to do two gallery pages for the same stupid thing. So just go over to Who's Who for the galleries page, folks. And Rob, where can they leave their comments on the show?
Let's go to fireandwaterpodcast.com and look for this post and leave the comments there on either both the Who's Who page or the JSA Who's Who listing and the JSA listing.
Perfect. All right. You can find us on Facebook as Fire and Water Podcast Presents. You can find us on Twitter as FW Podcast, or we have just JSA Presents as its own Twitter handle as well. We don't use it often enough, but, and I will tell you, in addition to being a Red B episode of Who's That for Who's Who, I am also committing that once the JLI podcast is done, my plan is to produce a lot of Once Upon a Geek and JSA Presents episodes. So you're going to get a lot more JSA Presents episodes in about a year or two from now. So we're going to slowly be ratcheting up how many we do of those. So look for those.
I'm looking forward to your Red B show where you're just going through every issue in order.
Well, you know, I have threatened to publish my Red B slash fiction. So we'll just have to see. All right. So that's going to do it, folks. Until next time. Join the fight
for justice.
And who's next? We never get that right.
We got it. Man, that was the closest we've done so far.
And then you like in some sort of fever dream. You guys make up this whole Golden Age, Earth 2 Aquaman nonsense. Sure, he existed in the Golden Age, but there was no Earth 2 Aquaman. He simply was in Earth. He was in Golden Age, and they just carried him through the foreground, and it was always Earth 1 Aquaman. They just didn't call it that back in the 40s. Because if you look in the thing you cited, All-Star Squadron number 31, where Liberty Bell says, oh, well, Aquaman can't be here. Right? You remember that?
Because he's generally at sea. Right. He's generally at sea.
Right, right. You see a little picture of Golden Age Aquaman, and Rob's running around going, there, see, he exists, he's real, it's Earth 2 Aquaman. No, that is her fever dream imagining him. He's not in the issue. That's her imagining him. He's a myth. He doesn't exist. He does not exist on Earth 2. Then, when you get around to issue 59, where the yellow-gloved Earth 2 Aquaman does show up, come on, let's all just admit it. That was 15 seconds before the crisis happened. That was Roy Thomas just being like, eh, I'll just throw this in there. What the hell? There's nothing to that. No, there's no Earth 2 Aquaman. That he existed. He didn't exist until that moment, until All-Star Squadron 59. That's the first time and only time that Earth 2 Aquaman ever existed. And it was 13 seconds before Crisis wiped him out. So I say no deal. No dice.
Are you there. Done?
I win.
No, you don't win. It's nonsense. Nonsense.
Yep.
Anyway, the two other things, I'm going to argue with that because you're just like, it's like a person with a tinfoil hat on the street corner. You don't go near them. You just keep walking around.
Can't argue with logic, my friend.
He was right there. Whatever. Anyway, the two things that we missed, forgot to mention in the show was one, Aquaman of Earth 2 does make another appearance in All-Star Squadron. Ha! That we forgot to mention. He is in All-Star Squadron number 53. He is in a panel where they're talking about calling in reinforcements. And Robot Man says, but there's all sorts of other heroes we could get in. We could get in on this. And he's like, Sargon the Sorcerer, Wildcat, and Aquaman. And we see Aquaman right there. So
you, again, you don't see him.
Oh, so Robot Man is also having a fever dream along with Liberty Bell? They both?
Sure. Yes.
Man, you are committed to this. You really are.
Yes, I am. There is no Earth 2 Aquaman.
Anyway, okay. And the other thing that that Mike and I touched on was the Secret Origins book from the 80s, which was a really, really fun book, edited by Mark Waid, featuring some of the greatest letters, pages in like any comic. And I was always perturbed, or more than perturbed, I was a Mr. Perturbed, was that Aquaman never got an origin. They did 50 issues of that book with two characters per issue, and they never did an Aquaman. Aquaman never got an origin, which really annoyed me. And so Mike found this little wonderful nugget, and this is – I'll read what he wrote. He said, I found the passage in All-Star Companion Volume 3 that had to do with the possible secret origin story featuring the Earth 2 Aquaman. In a sidebar piece titled Print the Legend, written by Jean-Marc L'Officer, he writes, quote, one of Roy and my – which is – this is Mark Waid speaking – collaborations that fell by the wayside as the direct result of crisis was a treatment for the secret origin title of the Earth 2 Aquaman. With Roy's approval and support, I had plotted a detailed origin and explained how hapless sailor Arthur Gordon Pym, from Edgar Allan Poe's eponymous narrative of, had stumbled into the Antarctic upon the remains of a lost city of the Dyson, an elder rage from Madame Blavatsky's influential century-old book, The Secret Doctrine. Mastering their science based on Viril, a form of psychic energy from popular Victorian author Edward Berkworth Lytton's 1871 novel, The Coming Race. Good Lord, I'm exhausted. Pym had built the Nautilus and become the science pirate known as Captain Nemo. Do I really need to source that one? And had even sunk the Titanic. Eventually, Pym's grandson, for reasons too complex to recount here, had become Aquaman. We were waiting for an artist to be signed to draw the story when the word came down that the Earth 2 Aquaman no longer existed and came and cameos and Ulster Squadron, to the contrary, in fact, had never existed. Whom are we to believe? Why are you taking such a joy in this? I don't understand. That's very nasty.
No, I have complete support for the Golden Age Aquaman. Just the fact that he is the same as the Earth 1 Aquaman. He is not from Earth 2.
Anyway, I'm not done reading. Whom are we to believe? The word of a DC editor or our lying eyes? So that was the origin, the secret origin of that Aquaman, unjustly relegated to the dustbin of history. Thomas would later... will you let me finish? For the love of Pete, shut up for five goddamn seconds. Thomas... God, man. Next week, Bailey is back in. At least he knows when to shut up. Thomas would later rework this idea into the origin of Neptune Perkins in a storyline for Young All-Stars, period. There is an Earth 2 Aquaman. Doesn't matter what DC said. There was. The fact that they blighted him out of history doesn't mean he doesn't exist. There. Done.
I would say that no, that's not true.
Oh my God.
Some writers planned to make him exist, but he never existed. Now, that whole thing, that was an incredibly complex origin. That, in fact, when you were reading it, all I could think was like, God, this sounds like Young All-Stars.
There you go.
Because that was a period of time where while I enjoyed it, they really went, I think, too far with trying to do deep, deep continuity stuff. Like a lot of the Young All-Star stuff was really tied in with stuff like that where they brought in, you know, now I love me some Iron Monroe, but you know, where they tied it into Gladiator. They really were trying to sew a fabric through every fiction of the 1930s, almost a League of Extraordinary Gentlemen style, and bringing it all into the DC heroes.
Well, I think most people agreed with you because that book didn't last.
Some of it I think had to do with the art. So, okay. But I try to love that comic so much.
Well, I just mean in general, people found Young All-Stars obviously not as compelling because it lasted like 2 years when All-Star Squadron lasted a lot longer. I mean, part of it was the crisis just completely screwed with all that stuff. So,
well, but I mean, it was a bit impenetrable. Young All-Stars was so.
Yeah.
But anyway, like why all that effort to create a different origin for the Earth 2 Aquaman than the Golden Age Aquaman's origin? Why couldn't you just use that where his dad was a scientist?
Well, no, they were tying it in. They were saying that that would lead to – because they're talking about that the guys would have the experimental work on people, and that's what the Earth 2 Aquaman's origin was. That's what the Golden Age Aquaman origin was his father experimented on him and taught him to breathe underwater and talk to fish, which is where he got that knowledge is from. They were backfilling this origin that they were going to do. So that's where we come
from. Okay, so it wasn't a contrary. It was an expanding upon.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. Well, you know, I do like me some Mark Waid. The guy who wrote that little piece, I can't even say his name, and I think you butchered it anyway. He has a long pedigree with Doctor Who too, so I'm a big fan of his. And then, so I mean, it's I like the people involved. I just think they were smoking the wacky weed. So
anyway, I don't know why you're so determined to die on this hill. There was an Earth to Aquaman. DC decided to get rid of him, just like they did with Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, Green Arrow, all that other stuff. So, you know, there you go. Anyway, people, you, any of you listening, you can decide for yourself who you believe. I think
there was clearly an Earth 2 Green Arrow, just not an Earth 2 Green Lantern.
Green Arrow, I meant to say. Green Arrow, yes.
There was clearly an Earth 2 Green Arrow.
Yes.
He was part of the Secret Soldiers, or whatever they're called.
Seven Soldiers of Victory.
Yes. Yeah. Yep. They met. Because, again, one of our listeners brought it up. When you look in the Justice League comics, they would always say, Earth 2, slightly different from Earth 1. There's two Supermen, or there's two Kal-Els, there's two Bruce Waynes, there's two Diana Princes, but some are different. And they'd show Dr. Fate and Aquaman's face.
Yes.
We know that. They're different.
Right. Then who is this other Aquaman?
There is no other Aquaman. It's the same guy. It's just if you look at his
origins. Then why does he have two different origins?
Because they change everybody's origin every couple years.
They didn't.
Trust me.
No, they didn't. They didn't change Superman's origin. They changed Batman's origin. They didn't change Wonder Woman's origin. No, they did. What are you talking about?
Wonder Woman's origin has changed. She's made from freaking clay now. She's Zeus's daughter.
Oh, my God.
Okay. Superman's origin changed minutely every few years.
He's the son of Krypton. What are you talking? What
that
the hell are you talking
that,
about?
That part's the same, but like it would change whether he was infant or a toddler and the
shell. Oh, my God.
And all that stuff. Did the Kents take him to an adoption agency or did the Kents just keep him?
Are you really saying to me that deciding whether Clark was an infant or when he was a toddler when he arrived is the same as two completely separate Aquaman origins? You're saying those are the same thing?
No.
Well, then what are you talking about? Clearly, there's two different Aquamans. The fact that a couple of editors in the 70s said, oh, no, we didn't. That's ridiculous. It's clear. They were trying to patch up this weird thing that they realized, oh, geez, we didn't really make accommodations for Aquaman. But there clearly was an Earth 2 Aquaman. Roy Thomas has him show up in the book. The fact that he only shows up for a day before he's obliterated doesn't make his existence any less substantial. He's there. Who are these people talking to? Who is that guy that the JSA is saying, hey, Aquaman, thanks for showing up? Who is that guy then?
But the point I'm saying is he was created at that point. He doesn't tie back with all the Golden Age adventures of Aquaman. You can't do that. The Golden Age Aquaman is the same as the Silver Age Aquaman, which is the same as the Modern Age Aquaman. It's just his, or you just accept that the stories happened a little differently.
All right. We got to end the show. People, I want you to weigh in on this, and I am confident that I will. You know, it doesn't really matter because Roy Thomas is the ultimate authority on this other than Roy Thomas. I mean, really, who else is there really to make this decision other than one of the guiding lights of comic bookdom, superhero continuity? But, I don't know why you're so obstinate on this point. But you are. I think you're just doing it to be argumentative because that's who you are. And you're mad at me because I dumped you from the show last week and replaced you with Michael Bailey. So I just think that's what it is. That your immaturity is just coming through and you're angry and I understand that. So, you know, God help mercy on your children and your wife.
Thanks for listening, folks. Fan the flame and ride the wave.
You can follow our Tumblr, which is firewaterpodcast.tumblr.com. And you can send us an email about this very fun episode at firewaterpodcast@comcast.net. And as Shag said, fan the flame and ride the wave. We'll see you next week.
Bye.
Bye.